All right. Well, hello, everybody. My name's Genevieve Grant, and I'm an academic in the law school at Monash University in Melbourne. I'm very glad to have Tim here as the chair for the session as well. I wanted to start out by setting a bit of a scene about this talk and why I'm here and why this might be a useful presentation for you. I think particularly at this point of the program, you know, it's been a big couple of days. There's been a lot said, and you know, I was speaking to somebody else here a bit earlier about how often at this point you can start to feel a bit like, oh, I've got to take all this home with me. How's it all going to fit together? What does it mean for me? And I think that's especially the case when you come to a law academics talk at the end of your actuaries conference and might be thinking, what can I get out of the room now? No, you can't. The doors are shut, I'm afraid. So you're in it for the long haul. But basically, you know, I mean, when I arrived at the conference yesterday and I picked up the sticker that said that my first one of these was in 2011, you know, it caused me to reflect on the fact that although I'm not an actuary, this has been my kind of mainstay conference in lots of ways. And the reason for that is that I do research about injury compensation schemes, but from a legal perspective. You know, my professional background is as a personal injury lawyer on the plaintiff's side, and I then retrained in public health and now do research around schemes, their impacts on participants particularly. I also teach and research in litigation and dispute resolution. So my kind of combined interest in people's outcomes in schemes and also dispute system design and litigation processes all really adds up to being obsessed with injury schemes. And that the counterpart to the fact that actuaries are so focused on injury schemes is that lawyers absolutely neglect them, you know. Like, I mean, there are the lawyers who practice in schemes and act for claimants or insurers, but lawyers' investment in the ongoing health and development and evaluation of schemes is close to nil, you know. I mean, the one exception to that might be the plaintiff lawyers and their advocacy in scheme settings at various points in time, you know, in a way that I'm trying to find a polite way of saying aligns with their interests and sometimes overlaps with clients' interests and sometimes doesn't. You know, I mean, I can say that. I used to be one of those. But there's a real gap, I think, in terms of thinking about the sort of the justice dimension of compensation schemes a lot of the time. And sometimes there's a risk of aligning justice with kind of lawyers' interests or with common law. You know, like those things are not the same. And so what I wanted to do was kind of take stock at this point in my advancing age and experience in research on compensation schemes and offer some observations about the way that justice is appearing in themes in discussion around compensation schemes in sort of contemporary discussion about schemes, I guess. And to do that from sort of two points of view, one is that my colleague Jason Taliodorus and I, who his name is up here. Jason and I write a textbook about Victorian statutory compensation schemes together. He and I have had a look at some of the schemes that have proliferated in Australia in the last 10 to 15 years. I mean, I know most of us here are interested in CTP and workers' compensation schemes, but we've really had a boom in schemes over that period because of the advent of institutional abuse, stolen generation schemes. And so Australia sort of stands out in lots of ways as being a scheme-producing country. Like, we love a compensation scheme. I mean, they take various kinds of forms. Of course, we have our significant standing statutory schemes. We've also got our much more discretionary, time-limited, even ex gratia payments kind of represent a sort of a process for providing people with compensation. So Jason and I have had a look at some of these more recent schemes and had a real kind of a close analysis of the way these schemes have paid attention to some of these themes around justice and claimant experience in recent times. And we've paired that with an analysis of the kind of the cross-disciplinary literature about schemes and claimant outcomes and dispute system design and lived experience that are really kind of emerging and driving a focus on claimants' outcomes and sort of justice themes in schemes. So it's a bit back-looking, a bit forward-looking. I'm hoping there'll be something you can take from this for your own scheme setting and thinking about how a different kind of disciplinary perspective on schemes might be relevant in your own setting. So in terms of the background here, as I've said, I mean, you know, I'm preaching to the converted here, obsessed with schemes, really fascinated by the kind of the compromise of policy values and priorities that they represent. You know, I mean, you know, I think any of the presentations at this conference could start with a kind of a slide that says, yes, we acknowledge there are kind of multiple objectives and, you know, some of us are more interested in some of those objectives than others and, you know, clearly not an actuary, not across the financial sustainability side of things, not a strength of mine. So I put that up front. But, you know, I think certainly schemes do a terrific job of holding these different objectives in tension. And really, you know, compensation schemes are kind of the original legal disruptor. I mean, these are schemes that are a response to the failings of common law a lot of the time. I mean, even where they modify common law, they do that to try and improve claimants' outcomes and reduce delay and what have you. So I think thinking about schemes as kind of the main way that justice gets delivered to injured people is a really important focus. And they really are everywhere. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, I think sometimes we have a very siloed approach. You know, we might think of ourselves as being a CTP or workers' comp person. Sorry, Tim, that's not directed at you. But, you know, sometimes we sort of wear those hats. But of course, schemes are kind of reinvented across different jurisdictions and different injury types all the time. And this happens internationally too. You know, I mean, I think some of you may be across those developments in the UK to do with the post office scandal. You know, that sort of great IT failure that caused a whole bunch of postmasters to be prosecuted for fraud and theft when actually it was not, there's no evidence of them having engaged in wrongdoing, and there's been a massive compensation scheme established in response to that. I mean, of course, we have the September 11 scheme, if we go back as far as that. I mean, schemes happen everywhere, but we don't really sort of bring that together and learn in a really overt way from those schemes. I'll put an asterisk on that. I think actuaries probably do, but beyond the actuarial community, you know, in the sort of broader research community, we don't tend to pay enough attention. So thinking about how we might avoid reinventing the wheel and, in fact, learn better from what's happened in schemes, and with a view to the sort of the justice dimension of what happens is really the kind of the main priority of this work. And really it's to avoid those justice concerns being relegated or minimised or treated as kind of consistent with preserving common law damages. You know, sometimes that's what happens. It's like justice equals common law, and that's not an accurate reflection of all the things that justice can be in a scheme. You know, I mean, justice means lots of things, but principally in the scheme setting, we're thinking about procedural justice, you know, people being treated fairly and fair processes and consistency of outcomes. Also distributive justice, you know, are people actually getting a fair outcome in terms of what's distributed to them. We might also think about the sort of the social justice dimension, you know, what capacity is there for schemes to really think about whether people are getting equitable outcomes across, you know, different community groups and what have you. But that procedural justice focus, I think, is a really significant one. So that's a long-winded way of saying that our proposal is really for thinking about what are the sort of the evidence-based design principles we might put into place for thinking about justice in our contemporary compensation schemes, and really looking beyond common law as the main lens for that, and giving effect to this as a kind of a series of design principles. And yeah, and I just to reiterate, I mean, I think the point of bringing a kind of a justice lens is to really give effect to those statutory scheme objectives that we sort of see in outstanding schemes, you know, that often talk about delivering compensation in a just way, or returning people to work and health in a just way, and really preventing those concerns from being sidelined. And, you know, I hate to be the one who brings up social license. You know, I work in a university. We sort of talk about social license all the time. Like, you know, are we doing the right thing by our community? But I think whenever we then get to a point of legislative reform, the social license of schemes is really important. You know, I mean, people need to have faith and trust in our schemes to be doing the just thing. And I don't know if there's any New Zealanders in the room, but I'm always struck when I go to New Zealand about the different perception and disposition that people there have towards the ACC compared to some of our schemes. And I think that kind of really reflects a sense of the justice that's done. Okay, so some of the key concepts that I wanted to talk about here. I mean, firstly, this idea of design and design principles. You know, I probably have to spend more time talking to my law colleagues about what that is than you necessarily. But I think, as I said, you know, we really acknowledge that that the schemes do represent a compromise between competing policy priorities and principles. But we're interested not just in the rules or the actual statutory form of the schemes, but also how they how those rules are made, how they're communicated, and how they're put into practice, and how they're evaluated. You know, all that supporting activity that goes on around schemes to communicate, particularly to participants, about what the scheme involves, and the evidence base that that we've drawn on to kind of distill these principles really reaches across the broad spread of research and evaluation evidence. You know, in Australia, we're in this really kind of special position of having such a long history with compensation schemes that we have so much good quality research and evidence about what works and for whom. And I think that's a really special thing, really drawing on that to make good on these principles, I think is an important step. I'm also interested from a kind of a legal point of view at the sort of the more recent developments that have happened around bodies of work in fields like legal capability. I've mentioned to a few of the people at the conference that, you know, there's been this massive uptick in work in legal scholarship around the concept of legal capability, which is this idea of the resources and skills that individuals have that they're able to bring to bear to solve legal problems that they encounter in their daily lives. So it's a bit like health literacy plus, you know, but in connection with legal problems. And I think that the plenary we had this morning, and, you know, the discussion about, you know, that sort of differing ability that people might have to be able to challenge a decision of a disability or compensation scheme, you know, legal capability goes to the heart of that. Like, there's strong evidence now that tells us that people's legal capability varies in the community, and we're able to measure that and assess that, you know, and predict how people might respond to legal problems. So I think there's a real, you know, a real benefit in thinking about what those sorts of bodies of work might mean. In addition to that, you know, we've been talking a lot about lived experience, but participatory design as well, you know, those sorts of fields of initiative. From my kind of more law home, you know, the sort of the broader fields of dispute system design and appropriate dispute resolution have a real home in this body of work too. So how is it that we can work to prevent disputes from happening? You know, that was also on the table this morning, I think, in the discussion around the NDIS. You know, how can we, rather than necessarily upskilling people to kind of do battle at a tribunal, how can we design processes so that we can actively prevent disputes from happening? And then there's a whole body of work around social psychology and procedural justice, administrative burden theory, you know, which kind of looks at how much schemes and administrative decision processes impose on participants, you know, require them to produce things and go through processes in order to access benefits. So those are some of the key bodies of work that we've drawn on. And of course, the really significant grey literature, that feels like really, you know, talking down the significant body of work that comes out of events like this and, you know, statutory reviews of schemes and all that important evidence. But really, we're trying to go sort of one level up and think about some principles to come out of that. And I mentioned earlier those more recent Australian schemes that we've had a look at. I mean, of course, there's a real focus of those at the sort of on the institutional abuse field. There's a few others there though, and I think those have been useful examples for us about sort of emerging trends in scheme design, albeit with some very different legal wrongs in mind. So that is the long-winded background. What I'm going to do now is just talk you through these principles. Now, there are eight, okay, so I warn you, just be, you know, there's a few. Yes, very keen to hear your feedback. So the first of these principles that we've settled on is that we really think that the choice of legal form really ought to be deliberate and supported by an inclusive design process. So I'm thinking here about a new scheme, but these are also principles that are relevant for thinking about how our existing schemes operate too. And side note, I also think they're relevant for thinking about how class action settlement administration happens as well. I mean, that's a whole other body of work, but, you know, another field in which we sort of have, you know, large sums of money being distributed to people who've been injured. Anyway, side note, I guess. So compensation schemes really take a wide variety of legal forms, and these forms create different sorts of opportunities for engagement with participants or potential participants. So of that collection of recent schemes that Jason and I have looked at, three of them arise by regulation. Two of them are statutory, so the National Redress Scheme, the Victoria Police Scheme, for instance. There's one that's by guidelines, another by a sort of a statutory instrument, And one, the Australian Sports Commission program is a product of a, well, it's sort of generated out of the governing body of a statutory government authority. So, I mean, a wide variety of ways in which these schemes come about, and there's a wide variety of approaches that are used to sort of set them up. And I guess we mention that because it seems like there's quite a bit of ad hocery that goes on, you know, like not necessarily clear guidelines on why one form is better than another. Often these schemes are generated in circumstances where there's a need for a kind of a political response to a demonstrated wrong or something that's emerged in the community as being a problem that requires compensation. And so that might be why, you know, a quick response is needed. So maybe some of these more discretionary approaches. But those questions around form and the time taken have implications about how participants might be engaged in their design, you know. And I think the design of the vaccine compensation scheme, for instance, has been sort of highly criticised because of how quickly it had to be rolled out, but how little consultation there was with affected people over the course in connection with that scheme. So that discussion we've been having over the last couple of days about lived experience. I mean, I think increasingly new schemes incorporate lived experience at the design stage, which is obviously not something we can do with our standing statutory schemes, but they do provide a good example of how that might happen and the benefit that it generates. So that a second of our principles, and, you know, I acknowledge these are aspirational, but is that supports should be person-centred, you know, which has been a theme of previous actuaries conferences, but also address claimants' financial and non-financial needs. And I think we've probably all observed that there's an increasing discussion about the non-pecuniary needs that, that claimants have when they come to a compensation scheme and how those might be addressed. Restorative justice programs seem to be flourishing all around the country in lots of different compensation scheme settings. And I think that's a real reflection of an increasing understanding that it's not enough to compensate people financially. You know, often they have other needs for apology or for restoration in different ways that compensation schemes can address. And I think the fact that we looked at institutional abuse schemes, you know, it's not a coincidence that this has kind of come out of that work because it's so much of a feature of those particular schemes and programs. But I think there are also workers' compensation and CTP settings, or the TAC in Victoria, of course, where those restorative style approaches are increasingly gaining traction. Evaluations yet to come, I think, and I think sometimes we don't think about the limitations in a compensation scheme environment of people making apologies to one another when you know, there might be legal reasons why they might not do that, or in fact the statute sometimes prevents them from doing that. But it's certainly a trend in a sort of a widening sense of what justice might mean for people in a claims process that you know, the distributive outcomes are not cutting it, and there are other other needs that people have. So the third of our principles is that the way that information is communicated to people about the benefits and support that they can access and the processes by which claims are assessed and benefits delivered really need to facilitate participation decisions. And I know it sounds like a cliche, but meet claimants where they are. You know, I mean, I think we've certainly observed a trend where it used to be that compensation schemes would hide the ball a bit on what might have been available. And, you know, I'm thinking of the TAC and common law claims as a kind of a case in point for this. I mean, that scheme has done a huge amount of work to make much clearer to claimants the possibility of a common law claim and what that entails. I think it used to be that their mindset was, if we don't give people information, they might not work it out. And of course, Google has prevented that from being a reality, because as soon as you look for compensation in a scheme, up pops a series of other information resources, probably from law firms that that address those needs, and perhaps not in the way that the scheme might prefer. So I think our increasing view is that the way that people are provided with information about those entitlements really needs to help them engage with the scheme rather than hiding the ball in that way. And, you know, that's really consistent with all of that evidence about early intervention and getting people to treatment and support as soon as possible, and is also reflected in the number of early decision programs and mechanisms to facilitate early access to people by benefits, you know, provisional payments and the like. So that's something that's, yeah, we've observed as a trend, and sort of one way of describing that might be enhancing access to justice, you know, making access to schemes easier rather than having that initial engagement with a scheme as being a barrier. The next of the principles is around this idea of the tension between some of these key decision qualities we might see in a compensation scheme. So it's a mouthful, but we're sort of interested in this idea of how certainty, efficiency and claimant experience are prioritised in decision making. You know, I mean, those attributes of a decision process or a claims process are often in tension with one another. You know, being able to deliver certain outcomes often comes at the expense of efficiency, and there may be implications for claimant experience as well. You know, in litigation settings, we talk about this as a kind of a pyramid with three values of a decision process in tension. So there's rectitude of decision, which is kind of the accuracy of the outcome or the truth of it. There's the speed with which decisions can be made, and then there's the cost. And typically, it's achievable to do well on two of those fronts, but the third will fall down, you know. So we might be able to establish a really fast decision process, and it might cost quite a lot of money, but the outcomes might not be terribly accurate. You know, it's that way in which we might hold those values in tension. I guess our principle here is that being conscious and clear with participants in particular about what's being prioritised in decision-making as far as that's possible is really beneficial. So if you want to make the decision processes faster, there will be a trade-off in terms of accuracy in the longer term, you know, and I think making those attributes clearer to claimants would come with some benefits. You know, I mean, I can't help but think about, for instance, I mean, I had to renew my passport recently. I don't know if you had to do that recently at all, but they tell you very clearly what the expected timelines are now for passport decision making. That's a kind of an attribute that we don't often see in decision making around administrative benefits. I know there's a whole lot of qualifiers around that and challenges, but I think clarity of information is something that participants are actively seeking a lot of the time. The fifth of these principles, nearly there, more than halfway through, I promise, is to do with claimant legal capability and the benefits of supported advice and advocacy. And, you know, I don't, it's funny, I remember, you know, Jeff Atkins, I think yesterday said, oh, I'm not into politics, I don't take a stand. I mean, I don't know Jeff at all, but it struck me as, I don't take a stand in relation to lawyer involvement. You know, that's my hill to die on. But I will say that that emerging evidence that I mentioned about sort of varying legal capability in the community, I think has real implications for compensation schemes because, you know, we're certainly operating in an environment where schemes and insurers have lots of access to good quality legal advice and information, and claimants have access to plaintiff lawyers for some types of claims and not so much for others. So even that discussion this morning in relation to the NDIS and being able to access advocacy and that real case study of, you know, being able to know someone who could provide you with assistance in a tribunal setting, I think is a real reflection of the fact that there are circumstances in which people do need advice or information, and there are benefits for a scheme that come with that, with having some groups of participants have access to that kind of support, helps to expedite decision-making and reviews and the like. And the generative AI discussion is a really interesting one here. I mean, you know, with the plenary yesterday and the talk about AI agents, I mean, all I could do was think about, well, are we moving to a time when every claimant will have an AI agent and that's who the scheme will get to deal with rather than the claimant directly? Like, is that optimal? No. I mean, so there will be sort of inefficiencies created from that. And I have to say, certainly from the court point of view, I mean, you'd all have seen in the media the reporting about, you know, lawyers doing the wrong thing where they use generative AI and then get found out. The other story that underpins that, of course, is this huge uptick in self-represented litigants who are using ChatGPT to draft submissions for courts, and courts being absolutely flummoxed and unable to deal with the huge volume of work that comes with that, with trying to reason with people who have completely wrong-headed ideas about the legal principles. And in fact, it represents a kind of a challenge to the rule of law, right? Because if we're sort of in a position where not everyone agrees on what the foundational law is, then the system falls apart very quickly. So, I mean, I don't mean to catastrophise, but no, it sounds like what I'm doing. But yeah, I think there's a real opportunity to kind of think about not only the benefits of some of these tools for enhancing claimants' legal capability, like certainly being able to access chatbots and other mechanisms, interfaces for finding out information about entitlements and processes and appeals and the like is really valuable. But there are some circumstances where that professional advice and advocacy also has a real benefit on all sides. So the evidence is increasing for us about that, and so I think it really ought to feature in our scheme designs. The sixth principle here is a slightly unusual one. It's really thinking here about the way that the supports that a scheme or a compensation program provides interact with benefits that might be available through other systems of support that people access. So colleagues at Monash have done a huge body of work looking at the interaction between workers' compensation when people cease benefits and then moved on to the disability support pension and being able to track people's movement across systems. I guess I'm also interested in when people's access to support through a scheme, excuse me, then precludes them from accessing other kinds of benefits. So, of course, lump sum compensation through a statutory scheme does preclude people from claiming Centrelink benefits. That interaction is not often well understood by participants, not often well understood by lawyers either. So we can often end up with injured people who find themselves precluded from Social Security for a significant period of time and then have to apply through the Administrative Review Tribunal in relation to those circumstances. I mean, only last week there was a news item on the radio about stolen generations compensation and people who'd received those payments then being subjected to means testing through the aged care system that was not anticipated by those who drafted the new aged care legislation. And so those interactions between significant systems of support have real implications for people who are being supported. And I think as a product of our kind of siloed approach, we don't often see those, and there are very many of them. So really making sure that people understand those interactions it's a significant feature of ensuring that people are adequately supported. I won't dwell on this one too much because I feel like I got a bit of ventilation this morning, but certainly constructive and accessible complaint review and appeal processes are a fundamental part of justice in schemes, you know, in terms of rectifying poor quality decisions, also amassing evidence of poor quality practice through complaints and review of that data, and generating better experiences and decisions through those mechanisms as well. You know, I mean, appeal processes have their place. You know, those edge cases that I think we've heard talked about in a few of the sessions today. Certainly there are circumstances in which appeal processes come to be leaned on too much, and we expect claimants to have too much legal capability to be able to navigate those. So thinking about making those accessible and constructive is really significant. Excuse me. And then the final of our principles will not be unusual to yours, I'm sure, but it's really about designing for evaluation and transparency in order to make sure that practice improvements can really draw on scheme design and the outcomes and experiences that the participants achieve. You know, I mean, law is notorious for setting up a scheme and walking away, you know. Like, I think often the legal stakeholders are not invested in, as I said, the kind of the ongoing monitoring and evaluation of schemes, and making sure that those mechanisms are put in place from the outset is really significant. Sometimes that drives better outcomes. I mean, I have to say the reviews of the National Redress Scheme haven't really had great things to say about it so far, and I think there's a lot of work to do to improve participants' experiences in that setting. But certainly thinking about evaluation as part of the design and including people with lived experience in evaluation processes and systems as well is a really critical feature for optimising kind of justice in schemes. So that was it. Well done. That was the eight. Just a few concluding thoughts. I mean, Jason and I are kind of very, very sort of set on this idea that really making these justice features of schemes more apparent, more overt, really helps clarify schemes and, you know, likely will improve experiences for participants, and also the process of future scheme design. I mean, odds are there'll be more wrongs, there'll be more harms, there'll be future schemes. As I've said, we've got a sort of a cottage industry in Australia in building more schemes. That seems to be something we enjoy doing. So I think making sure we learn from past practice in relation to schemes and do better, and really lean on the evidence base that we've amassed is an important important way of the part of the way that the practice should really develop in this field. Yeah, so really welcome your feedback and comments, and yes, more work to do. Anyway, thank you.
Oh, that's.
I mean, look, that's a great. I'm sure there's lots of people here who have a view about that, and could say something, something interesting about it. It's not something that I'm aware of there being huge amounts of good quality evidence about. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I mean, I think that the way that the evidence has developed about people's experiences in compensation schemes and how those contribute to health outcomes has meant that there is. I mean, I think all stakeholders are interested in making sure that people are not damaged by their experience in a claims process. And so I don't think that's something that has been confined to public or privately underwritten schemes. Like, it's a shared concern. I mean, I suppose from a sort of a justice and scheme design sort of a perspective, I mean, sometimes the publicly underwritten schemes are subject to additional obligations. You know, I'm thinking about sort of model litigant guidelines and, you know, sort of additional principles that have to be considered in the way that, you know, litigation is conducted. But that's a sort of real subset of activity that happens in schemes. So, yeah, I don't really have a concluded view. I think it can cut both ways. I mean, I guess I'm not really talking about the profit motive, you know, as having an impact here. I mean, yeah, but it's... not something I'm sort of convinced there's super strong evidence about.
Yep. Thank you. I think when you were talking about sort of different types of justice or concept, one of them was something like, I'd probably getting it wrong, but it's sort of administrative justice or something like that. How much of that do you think's got to do with design, and how much of it is the actual processes and things that happen later on?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question, because, you know, I think what the sort of the social psychology and socio-legal evidence tells us is that, you know, you can have a scheme design, the sort of the law on the books, we call it the black letter law, and then there's the law in action, you know, when you actually get humans involved in implementing it, and, you know, and there is a real role for culture, whether within an organisation or within a scheme setting or a jurisdiction, that has a really powerful impact on the way that justice systems of all kinds work. You know, I mean, I think any of you who've worked in multiple organisations in one jurisdiction will I'm sure will be able to observe that, you know, some organisations have a particular disposition, you know, and others might have a different disposition, and that's not about the law being different, you know, that's about how it's implemented being a different kind of a beast. So, yeah, I think I genuinely think it's a mixed bag, you know. I mean, That question of, though, of sort of administrative burden, which is connected to administrative justice, you know, the sorts of experiences people have in dealing with an administrative decision maker and scheme. I mean, those can be part of a design, whether it's statutory or whether it's at a kind of a policy level. You know, I mean, do we have policies about medico-legal assessment and, you know, how far we might make people travel to have those, or how long it's reasonable to wait for one or something like that. I mean, those are experienced by claimants as administrative burdens and are not necessarily a product of the law. So I think it's, I think it cuts both ways. Oh, classic Institute of Actuaries conference response. It depends, you know.
Yeah. So can I just one other quick one is that, a lot of the traditional schemes, as distinct from those ones that have emerged over the last few years, sort of have a dual role in terms of the prevention side as well as the compensation and rehab.
Yes.
Have you sort of given thought to the interaction between those sort of two limbs?
Well, that's really interesting because, I mean, I'm obviously from Victoria, you know, and have done work with the TAC and WorkSafe over time, and my experience has been in those businesses, they're quite separate functions. You know, although they're under the one roof, you know, when you're working with people in the compensation side of things, yeah, you might not speak to someone in road safety or in, you know, the equivalent in the work setting. So, yeah, I think that's a... I sort of take it on notice a bit, I guess. Yeah, because I mean, my sense is that there's a real strength in having those functions within the one business. But in these big organisations, I think there's siloing that happens as well.
Hopefully that's becoming less, though.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, just a very quick question from me, if I might. I'm thinking about the reforms that are on the horizon for the Commonwealth scheme with the SRC Act review. Mm. When we look at designing a scheme where we have a mandate for change, is it your view that enough is done up front in the design of the scheme before we then write the legislation to bring that scheme to life? Or are we doing too much of the, we've got a mandate, we write some laws and then we give it off when we talk about lived experience to contribute to legislation that actually is implementable and practical, not just from an injured person's perspective, but also from those who have to administrate the scheme?
Yes.
Have we got it in the right order, or are we...
No, I don't think so. And I think that's a kind of a product of law as a field and as a discipline. You know, I mean, I often sort of reflect on the difference between what happens in health services settings and how institutionalised effectively it is now for people with lived experience and a sort of system design to, you know, be a process of the development of new ways of doing things. And I think it's something about lawyers and drafters and their training, you know, that means that they are so focused on kind of generating the black letter law that it's sort of they sort of see themselves as quite separate to the kind of the end users of those pieces of legislation. So no, I think yeah, this is it. I mean, I think there's a huge amount of work to be done by law in that respect, and you know, I feel like there's a real risk of kind of tokenism and paying lip service to lived experience in a way that's really disrespectful and damaging. So, yeah, I think there's lots of opportunity to do better there.
Mm. Thanks. Thanks for the presentation. Very interesting. In the context of psychological injury, we've heard much about over the last couple of days, I've always had an interest in the role of apologies that don't go to liability. I just wonder if there's any work been done or you're aware of any schemes where that's been attempted, because it seems to be something we could think about in workers' comp, that often in those interpersonal generated contexts, an apology would go a long way to resolving them.
Absolutely. No, I mean, look, I have a number of colleagues who do work on apology in the law. I mean, Prue Vines, who's at the University of New South Wales, has done a huge amount of work in the medical indemnity kind of space, you know, where in that context it's much more developed and understood, you know, and there have been sort of legislative protections for apology. It's been really interesting. I mean, with the uptick of discussion around restorative justice, I found myself kind of getting into the guts of legislation around the Victorian schemes. And there are actually provisions that prevent people from apologising, you know, at the scene of an accident or, you know, doing so in a way that might prejudice a legal claim. And so there are real challenges around timing with apology too. You know, I mean, when that might happen, when there's sort of... the Sentencing Council in Victoria sort of looked at this in connection with sort of occupational health and safety and deaths and sentencing and whether restorative justice might have a place there. And there are real challenges because, you know, there might be a health and safety prosecution going on at the same time as there's a compensation claim. And, untangling all of that is really challenging. But at the same time, of course, I mean, you know, the discussion earlier today was really about that fact that sometimes what people want to do is to hear from their employer and soon. And sometimes systems and processes around compensation can impede that from happening. So, you know, I think there are ways of bringing people together that are short of restorative justice that are actually about sort of communication and staying in touch. Lots of benefit in that. And I think there's evidence from other fields that shows us that can be useful. Yeah.
Anyone else? I have a question. Mm-hmm. How do we know when we've nailed it? Is it a little bit like art? I don't know what art is, but I know what I like. How do we know when we've nailed justice in the design?
Oh, gosh. It's a good question, you know. I mean, because there are so many... there are subjective dimensions to it as well. You know, I mean, people have different expectations around a process, different expectations of a scheme, different ideas around what the impact of injury is and those kinds of things. So, I mean, I think the best we can do is kind of think about what are the kind of outcomes we might assess How can we best measure those? And those aren't things we've necessarily done terrifically well in compensation schemes so far. I mean, there's lots of participant satisfaction. You know, there's that evidence that we heard about this morning about, you know, the extent to which people feel like NDIS is responsive, you know, but, you know, I guess justice means different things for different types of claims as well. And someone who's had a common law claim with a contested, you know, hearing in court has a very different experience of justice in a scheme to someone who's had a relatively minor injury, being supported and got back to work, who might still have a strong sense of justice around what's happened, but without all of that exposure. So, sorry, it depends. Yeah, but no, good question. I think it is possible to measure, though, and I will say the Productivity Commission has got metrics for courts about people's experiences of those systems. The courts, every time that report on government services material gets produced, they say, oh, it's too hard, we can't do it. I'm just waiting for them to actually, you know, institute a survey. Like, that would be great. Yeah, anyway.
And we actually use the words, it depends as well.
What's that?
We say, it depends.
It depends. Oh, honorary actuary. I need another sticker for my name tag. Yeah.
Are there any other last questions? If not, can you please join me in thanking Janelle?
Thanks very much.